Chapter 25 Lord City, Lord. She was willowy tall, with long black hair in a flowing ponytail. Ben saw her first from the cockpit of Jason's shuttle as the vehicle drifted down on repulsor lifts. The woman was neither distinct nor interesting at that time, merely a shadowy figure leaning, arms crossed, against the hangar pit wall. But once they were grounded, cleared to emerge, and descending the shuttle's boarding ramp, she strode forward out of the shadows, and Ben suddenly found her very interesting indeed. Her robes, a green and tan-yellow combination not commonly seen on Jedi, were tailored to her, flattering her figure, and her wide-mouthed smile was a celebration that invited all who saw it to join in. Sadly, Ben's sudden interest was one-sided. She walked quickly to the ramp's base, her attention fixed on Jason, her hand extended toward the adult Jedi.
"Jason," she said, "it's good to see you."
Jason reached the bottom of the ramp and took her hand, but did not draw her into an embrace, not even the cordial embrace of old friends, though her body language, even to Ben's inexperienced eye, suggested that this was what she expected.
"Nelani," Jason said, "when I heard that you were the Jedi assigned to the Lord Station, that you'd be the one meeting us, I was glad—"
"Really?"
"Glad to realize that you'd passed your trials and were fully vested as a Jedi Knight," he continued. "Congratulations."
Her smile faltered slightly.
"Thank you."
She released her grip on his hand, and her attention finally turned to Ben.
"And this must be Ben Skywalker."
Ben stood silent. It wasn't that he didn't want to say anything. It was just that his entire vocabulary, including some choice swear words in Rodian and Huttese he'd gone to great pains to memorize, had just vanished. He wondered where it was. Nelani cast a worried glance at Jason.
"Does he talk?"
Ben's vocabulary suddenly returned.
"You're being condescending," he said.
Absently, she ruffled his hair.
"Certainly not. You just had me puzzled for a moment."
She returned her attention to Jason.
"So what did you want to do first? Get settled in your quarters at the station?"
She gestured toward the exit from the hangar pit, then led them in that direction.
"Have you researched the matter I calmed you about?" Jason asked.
Ben fell into line behind them, furiously smoothing his hair.
"Yes, and I found a contact who seems to know something about your tassels, a Dr. Hyalin Rotham. Tactile writing and recording methods are her specialty."
Dr. Rotham's offices, also her quarters, were on the ground floor of a university building built of duricrete bricks and falsewoods, then comfortably aged for a couple of centuries. The walls of the corridors and chambers were dark, either soothing or shadowy and threatening, depending on one's attitude toward such things, and so somber that it seemed to Ben that they could swallow all humor. Not that in the office chambers the walls were all that easy to see. Shelves lined the room, displaying books, scrolls, figurines of strangely misshapen males and females of many species, coils of irregularly knotted rope, and small wooden boxes with hinged lids. He looked over to the table where Dr. Rotham sat with Jason and Nelani. Dr. Rotham was a human woman, tiny and ancient. Her hair was white and wispy. Her skin was pale, traced with blue veins, and almost transparent. She wore a heavy maroon robe, even though Ben found the temperature in these chambers to be on the warm side, and her eyes were a piercing blue, unclouded by age. She sat on a self-propelled chair, a wheeled thing with a bulky undercarriage that suggested it was equipped with short-range repulsor lifts. She held Jason's massive tassels up before her eyes, scrutinizing them from a distance of only 4 or 5 centimeters.
"You have a lot of stuff here," Ben said.
Without looking at him, Dr. Rotham said,
I do, don't I? And what's remarkable is that every datum that can be derived from those objects has been recorded into my office memory for my datapads, into Lord's computer system, and into the computers of any person who has ever asked for them.
Ben took another look around the room's extensive banks of shelving. But if it's all recorded, why do you keep the original things? They take up a lot of room.
A reasonable question from a Jedi who must travel often and lightly. But you must remember that there is a tremendous difference between a thing and the knowledge of a thing. For instance, think about your best friend. Would you prefer to have your best friend, or a datapad stuffed full of knowledge about him?
Ben considered. He didn't want to give her the obvious, correct answer. It seemed like a defeat. Instead, he said, "That's a good question." It was an answer he had heard adults offer many times, one he suspected they used whenever they couldn't think of anything better to say. Jason chuckled, and Dr. Rotham did not follow up on her question. Ben concluded that he had held his own.
"This one," Dr. Rotham said, "is definitely Bith, a recording method of an isolated island race. The Alagar, that concocted the knotting style as a means of recording genealogies, strings of ancestors. Later, the technique was expanded to permit the recording of thoughts and statements. Roughly translated, it means he will ruin those who deny justice."
Nalani frowned.
"That's curiously ominous."
"Why?"
Jason asked.
"Yeah,"
Ben said. "Jedi do that all the time. Ruin those who deny justice." Nalani shook her head.
"Ruination is sometimes a result of what we do, but it's not usually the goal. Ruination as a goal sounds like vengefulness, not a trait suited to a Jedi."
Ben caught Jason's eye, silently requesting confirmation of Nalani's assertion. Jason shrugged unhelpfully.
"I'm certain I can translate many of the others," Dr. Rotham continued, "though, since they all appear to be separated from their cultural contexts, how accurate those translations will be is somewhat up in the air. Perhaps they provide a context for one another. If so, that will be helpful."
Jason nodded. "I'd appreciate whatever you could tell us." As he spoke, Nalani beeped, or rather something on her person did. She hurriedly fit a small hands-free comlink to the back of her right ear. She pulled part of the device loose, and it swung out, a little black ball to bob and sway gently at the corner of her mouth, suspended by a black wire so fine as to be almost invisible.
"Nalani Din," she said.
After a few moments of listening, Nalani frowned.
"Did he say why a Jedi?"
She paused, cocking her head to one side.
"And you think it's credible?" "Yes, I'll be right there. About 10 minutes. Out."
She tucked the bobbing microphone back up under her ear and rose.
"I apologize for ducking out, but I have to go."
"Emergency?" Jason asked.
"Yes. Some sort of lunatic in a starfighter threatening to launch missiles if he's not allowed to talk to a Jedi."
"I get the impression that it will take Dr. Rotham some time to complete any more translations."
Jason glanced at the elderly woman for confirmation, and at her nod he rose.
"I'll come with you."
"You'd be welcome," Nalani said.
It was an odd situation at the Lord City spaceport. A Y-wing starfighter, so battle-scarred and patched that it had probably been ancient at the time of the Battle of Yavin, had set down 50 meters from the approved landing zone. Nor had it landed on a flat surface. Its ion jet drive pods rested on a repulsor lift taxiing strip at right angles to the normal direction of traffic, and its nose was up on a meters-high Duracrete traffic barrier, leaving the starfighter at a 30-degree upward angle.
"He's short an astromech," Ben said.
Indeed, there was nothing in the circular gap immediately behind the cockpit.
"And it's modded for concussion missiles instead of proton torpedoes."
"He also has a nice firing angle on the most populous area of the city," said Lieutenant Neave Samran of the Lord Security Force, a heavy-set human man with brown hair and mustache grown just a bit longer than regulations probably permitted. He had his forces deployed all around the Y-Wing at distances of 50 to 200 meters, and snipers were conspicuous on hangar rooftops. Samran's command post, where the three Jedi had joined him, was at the corner of the corrugated durasteel-sided hangar 100 meters from the starfighter. Ben stood behind Jason, but to one side, where he could keep an eye on the Y-Wing and the faintly visible figure in the cockpit. Ben found he could actually feel the pilot there, as a hard knot of pain and confusion that faded and swelled, moving in and out of the boy's perceptions.
"Do you have any indication of whether he actually has live concussion missiles, and how he got them?" Jason asked.
Samran nodded.
"He sent us the telemetry from his weapons board. A one-way feed, blast it, else we'd have been able to slice into his controls and solve this without calling you in. He has a full brace of missiles aimed at the student housing districts. Precisely where, we can't be sure. As for how he got them, he doesn't have a credit left in what had been a decent-sized savings and investments account. With all the weapon smuggling going on these days, it's no surprise that an old pilot with lots of connections could get his hands on ordnance like that."
"What can you tell us about him?" Nalani asked.
Samran opened his data pad and consulted it.
"Ordith Hwar, age 81 standard years, human male originally from Lord. Back in the old Republic and Empire days, he was a shuttle pilot. At the height of the Rebel Alliance, he joined them and spent the war as a Y-Wing pilot, during which time he scored one half of a kill. His record as a Rebel pilot was undistinguished."
Nalani shot Samran an admonishing look.
"He was no less brave than pilots with better kill records."
Samran held her stare, unruffled.
"The comment about his record was offered as a possible key to his mental state. In my experience, people with mediocre skills and unremarkable records are more likely to come unhinged. They experience more frustration, less appreciation. Or do you disagree?"
Nalani's expression relented a bit, to one of milder disapproval, and she turned away to stare at the old starfighter again.
"Anyway," Samran continued, "he became a flight instructor after the Empire fell, and eventually retired and returned to Lord. He came out of retirement a few years back to shuttle Yuuzhan Vong war refugees around, and the records suggest that being kicked around from planet to planet, unwilling to accept refugees, did something bad to his outlook. After the Yuuzhan Vong war, he came back again, bought some rural property with his wife, and spent the next several years living off his pension and shooting blasters at intruders."
"Any children?"
Nalani asked.
"No children," Samran said. "And his wife died about 2 years ago."
2 years, Jason said. "What happened recently that put him behind a missile board threatening students?"
Samran shook his head.
"I guess I'd better talk to him," Nalani said.
She turned back to Jason.
"Unless you'd like to. You're senior."
Jason shook his head.
"No, I have another tactic I'll explore."
She nodded, made sure her robes were suitably straight and that the lightsaber hanging at her belt was clearly visible, then marched across the Plascrete parking area toward the Y-Wing. When she was 50 meters from the starfighter, the pilot's voice, broadcast over an external speaker system, boomed at her.
"That's close enough!"
The voice was thin, raspy. Nalani cupped her hands around her mouth to shout her reply.
"Whatever you say, Hwar, you didn't have to endanger all those students to talk to me. My station office can be reached by planetary net or comlink.
Ben felt the pilot's pain and confusion surge, stronger than he'd experienced it previously.
"You wouldn't have taken me seriously," the old man said. "You only understand force. Force and the force."
He laughed, a bitter noise, as if briefly entertained by his own play on words.
"Not true, but we don't need to argue the point," Nalani shouted. "I'm here now. Why did you want to talk to me?"
"What is a force ghost?"
Huar asked. Nalani was silent for a long moment.
"It's a survival, ascending from someone who has died, but still exists in a certain way."
"My wife is a force ghost,"
Huar said.
"She talks to me, but she can't, can she?"
Nalani took another step forward. Even distorted by shouting, her voice sounded dubious.
"Was she a Jedi? Or did she ever do things that suggested she might see things, feel things that normal people don't?"
"No."
Caught up as he was in the dialogue between Nalani and Huar, Ben had lost track of Jason. Now he became aware that his mentor was concentrating, channeling the Force. Jason reached out and pulled a handful of air toward him. Simultaneously, the Y-Wing's ion jet pods skidded backward across the Duracrete, sending up showers of sparks, just until the starfighter's nose slid off the barrier and crashed to the ground, facing directly into the Duracrete. Then he added a twisting motion, and the Y-Wing rotated along its long axis, crashing onto the taxiing strip upside down.
"There," Jason told Samron. "Problem solved. He can't lift off with repulsors or thrusters, and he can't fire his missiles at the city."
Samron looked at him in surprise, then choked up in laughter. Unable to speak, he waved the men and women of his security force toward the starfighter. They emerged from their protected positions and advanced. Ben could hear some of them laughing, too.
"What are you doing?"
That was Nalani, returning at a quick trot.
"I had the situation under control."
Jason turned a dubious look on her.
"No, you didn't. You were executing a decent negotiation, but to be in control, you would have had to be able to prevent him from firing at any moment. Could you?"
Nalani reached Jason and stood there, her features flushed, her expression confrontational.
"No, but he wouldn't have fired while we were talking."
"Tell that to the families of all the students who would have died if he had somehow fired without your detecting it. Or if he had his missiles set up on a timer, which you wouldn't have been able to feel. And don't tell me he wouldn't have. You had no control over his actions, and every moment you negotiated with him, you risked the lives of those students."
"You think I wasn't aware of his emotional state? His feelings were lit up like a landing circle."
While the two Jedi argued, Ben watched the spaceport security team approach the helpless starfighter. Then he felt a surge of despair from its pilot. Despair and determination.
"Get back!"
Ben astonished himself with the volume of his scream, with the fact that he was screaming without meaning to, with the fact that he was running forward with no voluntary control of his legs.
"Run! Run!"
The security agents froze at his first cry and looked back at him. Apparently, the force of will he was projecting and his proximity to Lieutenant Samron were enough for them. They turned away from the Y-Wing and began running. There was a hum from the starfighter, and Ben saw ignition within its missile tubes. There was a sudden expulsion of flame, missiles punching out of their tubes and into the Duracrete just in front of the starfighter. And then the Y-Wing exploded, propelled into metallic confetti by a hemispherical wall of flame and concussive force. As if in slow motion, Ben saw the wall of energy swell out toward him. He dropped to the permacrete-covered ground, wrapped his robe tightly around him, and focused his mind on the blast he could still visualize. He saw the point where it would hit him. He pressed against that spot, willing it to weaken, to slow. It hit him. He felt himself pushed as if by a giant hand, a hand radiating ferocious heat. He rolled and skidded backward, then came to a stop. There was no sound. His ears felt as battered as if a wampa had boxed them. But he felt oddly peaceful, as though he had been exercising all morning and was ready for a rest. Languidly, he threw his robe off his face and stood up. The Y-wing was gone. Where it had been was a crater, and the duricrete barrier that had stood before it was interrupted by a rough-edged gap many meters long. The buildings nearest the explosion were still standing, but they leaned away from the source of the blast, their metal skeletons bent, the exterior walls facing the blast dented in or missing entirely. Everywhere there were bodies, some of them licked by flame, and Ben thought for one cold moment that his effort had been too late. But one of the burning men suddenly began to roll on the ground, smothering the flames rising from his back and shoulders, and a woman a few meters from him stood up on shaky legs. Ben saw Jason racing toward him, but then Jason, seeing that his cousin was not badly hurt, veered off toward victims who were still unmoving. Ben chose a nearby group of security personnel and moved toward them, his steps unsteady at first, then gaining in balance and sureness as he ran. An hour later, Ben sat in a hangar. A brightly painted but antiquated shuttle dominated the center of the building. Ben had his back against a corrugated durasteel wall, which flexed slightly as he leaned against it. Other rescue workers sat against the same wall, drinking cups of caff some of their number had provided, exchanging gruesome stories of explosion disasters of the past. Mostly they left Ben alone, but they had brought him caff and told him he'd done well. And now the crisis was over, and the medics and firefighters were resting and replenishing themselves for a few minutes before returning to their respective bases. Jason and Nalani re-entered the hangar through the main sliding door. They spotted Ben and headed his way. Jason sat beside his cousin, while Nalani remained standing. "Guess what?" Jason asked. Ben could hear him clearly enough now, a very faint ringing in his ears, the only remnant of the effects of the explosion. "What?" "No dead." Ben looked at him, startled. "None of them died?" "Not one. Well, not counting the crazy men in the Y-wing. But it seems that every one of the security men and women will make it. Not one seems to be in critical condition, thanks in part to their body armor, but mostly to you."
"Lubed," Ben said.
Nalani said,
"While Jason and I were arguing about procedure, you were doing what a Jedi should, being mindful of the Force."
"So we get to take note of your example today, instead of the other way around," Jason continued. "I also thought you should have a reward."
"What reward?" Ben asked.
"The rest of the day is yours. Nalani and I are returning to Dr. Rotham's now. You can accompany us, you can go sightseeing, you can check out a ground speeder and improve your piloting skills, whatever you like. You have enough credits to get by, and you know how to get to Dr. Rotham's, I believe." Ben nodded. He didn't let it show on his face, but his mind was spinning. The rest of his day left to his own devices, unsupervised. That was indeed a reward, and, he was dimly aware, it was also a sign of trust. "Thanks," he said. Jason rose. He and Nalani headed back out the way they'd come, heads bowed together as though they were renewing their argument, leaving Ben to figure out what he wanted to do with himself. Though he didn't know it, Ben was right. The two Jedi Knights began quarreling again as soon as they reached the exit from the hangar, though they handled their disagreement more civilly than before.
"I really wish," Nalani said, that you'd given me another minute or two with Huar. I'm really curious about this force ghost business of his.
Students, Jason said, in a tone that suggested his one-word argument should settle the whole matter.
Yes, yes, the students in their quarters were in danger. I'm not disputing that. But couldn't you have surreptitiously squeezed the ends of his missile-launching tubes closed? That way, if he'd fired, same result. But until then, I'd have been able to talk to him. Maybe I could have gotten to the root of his craziness.
They reached the anonymous gray speeder that had brought them to the spaceport. They hopped in, Nalani behind the controls.
I suppose I could have, Jason admitted. It didn't occur to me. And it does beg the question of whether someone who threatens the lives of thousands of innocents deserves any consideration whatsoever.
Maybe he deserved consideration for being a war hero.
Nalani activated the repulsors and sent the speeder skyward. Jason made a dismissive gesture.
My father is a war hero, too. I don't recall him ever doing what Huar did.
And Huar never smuggled spice for Hutt crime lords, either.
Jason shook his head.
Sometimes it's a disadvantage having a father so famous they make holodramas about him.
Nalani grinned.
With you, I have to exploit any conversational advantage I can get my hands on.
You're definitely not the late-blooming force-sensitive I taught lightsaber technique to.
I'm glad you noticed.
Jason ignored that remark, as well as the rather personal tone with which it had been communicated.
It's time we turned our attention back to Dr. Huar and those tassels.
Not just yet. I've been trying to turn your attention to me.
He grinned.
You really have gotten bolder.
She nodded.
Learning how to and having the ability to cut Gundarks in half went a long way toward overcoming my shyness problem. And being a Jedi, the only Jedi assigned to this world, means I have very little time of my own, so I tend to get to the point rather quickly. Does that bother you?
Jason shook his head, but kept his attention on the terrain, long banks of warehouses graduating to blocks of low-rent businesses, speeding by beneath their vehicle.
No, but there's someone...
Someone occupying that particular place in your life?
Yes.
She made a chiding noise.
Well, then, let's just spend a little time together, which, incidentally, I wanted very badly to suggest 7 years ago when you were teaching me lightsaber technique, but I was too self-conscious.
Jason smiled and offered no further explanation. Nalani shook her head, a gesture of mild regret, and fell silent.